If they can do this, if the government wins in this case, we're all in big trouble. Because the First Amendment really would have been, will be, so eviscerated and so meaningless that we really, it won't exist anymore. And that's the real danger and the importance. Obviously, the importance of this case has to do with the four defendants. But it has to do with all of us. And unless we put a stop to this, we're in bigger trouble than we've been for a long time.
One thing that we're extremely conscious of, like in all of our support work, is how do we make those connections, like to broader struggles, and to repression that people have faced, like in the past, at different times, as well as things that are happening currently, and things that we know are going to happen in the future. We're trying to situate like what's happening to Scott and Kerry within a much broader context, and the relevance for people who aren't currently facing grand juries is that the system itself exists, and it exists in great secrecy, and it can be like employed against their communities at any time.
In that context, how do you talk about what a reasonable fear is? If this law, if you have an ambitious prosecutor, which we have quite a few of right now, and they're trying to make their name with an anti-terrorism case, and they haul people before into court, making a case against some activist group or some, you know, some individual, and they're arguing that these people are instilling a reasonable fear. How do you talk about reasonable fear in this political climate? That's like talking about what is a reasonable fear, you know, in, during the Red Scare. Well, it's not reasonable, but at that time, it's been manufactured and constructed in a way to make people afraid.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we will explore the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Our guests are defense attorney Robert Bloom, Tom Addo from EWOC, Earth Warriors Are Okay, and Jude with the Scott and Kerry Support Committee. We'll also hear excerpts from a few talks by journalist Will Potter. Stay tuned. We start off tonight with an excerpt from a speech made March 3rd, 2009, from Will Potter. The title of the speech is called, How Does the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act Work? The speech was about an hour long, and the whole speech can be heard at greenisthenewred.com.
So what we're starting out as, we should notice, it's the name of it is being changed to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which isn't an accidental change by any means. And what it's doing, the offense is, this is standard, you have to travel in interstate or foreign commerce, or use the mail or any interstate facility, and it's just saying, setting up interstate nature to make it a federal case. And this is the real meat of it right here. It has to be for the purposes of damaging or interfering with the operations of an animal enterprise. Now, animal enterprise is defined in the definition section as being so broad that it includes any business that uses animal products. It's not just a factory farm or a circus. It's a fast food industry. It's a barbecue restaurant. It incorporates, it encompasses all of those things. And this damage or interference, the government isn't spelling out what that actually means. And this is really the first huge problem that comes up in these just these couple paragraphs of the law, is the government doesn't define what damaging means. In the definition sections, it talks about economic damages, and that's included as the loss of profits. So when I testify, I say, you know, that's the entire reason activists do their work. I mean, they're all trying to affect the loss of profits. Anyone targeting a corporation, corporations by law cannot be concerned with anything else except protecting their profit. So the only way to affect business is to go after profits. I mean, I don't think anyone, regardless of how you feel about these issues, would think a corporation is going to care about much less. I mean, they have to protect their financial interests. And by definition, that's what most activists do. I mean, every civil disobedience, every protest, every boycott, every letter-writing campaign is meant to affect profits. In a more extreme sense, that's what the entire animal rights movement, environmental movements are about, is through their lifestyles of these people, whether you're an activist, but if you're just a an environmentalist who tries to buy, these are poor examples, but, you know, you're buying a hybrid and hemp products and sustainably grown produce at the co-op, and you're a vegetarian or a vegan, and you're not buying fur, and all these different things. Those are all very personal decisions, but they're also financial decisions about affecting corporate profits through your outreach and through your lifestyle. So that's a big red flag. I mean, they define economic damage, and the members of Congress all said economic damage only applies to the penalties section. So in that actual offense section, we never even spell out what damaging means. We're talking about a terrorism statute, and we're not even explaining what the terms actually mean of damaging or interfering. If damage or cause loss of real or personal property, you have to place the person in reasonable fear of death or serious bodily injury, or at the conspiracy element. So with the first part, you know, ostensibly, it intentionally damages or causes the loss of any real or personal property. Ostensibly, that's meant to go after the groups that are out there with black masks in the middle of the night, breaking windows and spray painting ALF and ELF or whatever they're doing, right? I mean, that's at face value, that's what it seems, and that's what they say they're trying to go after. The people that are out there using direct action against property, they're using sabotage. But because we never spell out what that term damages means, and we never spell out real or personal property, and also we add on this clause of the real or personal property of anyone doing business with this industry, the government is automatically inflating it to pretty big terms rather than trying to pare it down and being very specific. The second part, though, the reasonable fear, is, I think, in my opinion, it's the most dangerous part of this entire piece of legislation. And as a little bit of background, everything about what's going on right now, and I use the term the Green Scare because I think it resonates with people to draw comparisons with what's going on right now to perhaps the most famous era or infamous era of government repression in U.S. history, of the Red Scare of the 20s and also the 40s and 50s, and the relentless labeling of people as communists simply because of their political beliefs. And how that era operated, it wasn't about the people that were true national security threats. It wasn't about communist spies, and it wasn't about people breaking into NSA headquarters and funneling information to communist governments. That era, all of McCarthyism and the Red Scare, went after anyone who has that belief system. And the way they did that is by instilling fear in everyday people. That's how the House Un-American Activities Committee worked. That's how the blacklist worked. That's how the congressional hearings worked. That's how Joseph McCarthy, you know, standing up and holding his list of names at press conferences. That wasn't meant to be police work or prosecutorial work. That was meant to instill fear in everybody paying attention.
You're listening to a speech by Will Potter, given in March 2009.
So in short, the Red Scare, if nothing else, was about making unreasonable fears of your neighbor as a communist become a reasonable fear. To make an unreasonable fear of, you know, all those guys out in Hollywood. What about Dr. Spock? Dr. Spock, the baby doctor, I hear he's a communist, and he was actually investigated and blacklisted. I hear he's a communist. So it's about making unreasonable fears of people like Dr. Spock and people opposing the war and everything else, make them communists and make everyday people afraid of them, blacklist them, destroy their lives, and destroy a political ideology. Right now, what's going on is the exact same thing. These corporate smear campaigns, which have included anonymous ads in the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, they've included media campaigns labeling people as eco-terrorists and domestic terrorists, not just people that are doing illegal actions, but the head of Yum Foods, which is the owner of KFC, testified before Congress that People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, in the opinion of Yum Foods, which is one of the biggest corporations in the country, are corporate terrorists because they're asking them to change their business practices at the time as in regard to how chickens are housed and treated before they're slaughtered for KFC. Corporate terrorists testifying before Congress about that. They've gone so far as to label children's movies like this movie Hoot as softcore eco-terrorism for kids because the kids are vandalizing construction equipment because they're trying to save a spotted owl. They've gone so far as to, you know, the FBI is attempting to infiltrate vegan potlucks in the Twin Cities area. I mean, I run this website, greenisthenewred.com, and on it, I focus on a lot of these stories, and there was also another introduction to the Green Scare where I can kind of compile not just the most absurd cases like this, but to show that they're the norm. They're not exceptions to the rule. All this stuff is the norm right now. So all of this, all of these ad campaigns and these the terrorist press releases and the radio interviews and the media campaigns and the congressional hearings are all about making unreasonable fears of animal rights and environmental activists who at their very worst have only damaged property. They have never harmed a human being, according to the FBI. So it's making fears of these groups seem reasonable and seem like a national security threat. So that's a long way of saying, in that context, how do you talk about what a reasonable fear is? If this law, if you have an ambitious prosecutor, which we have quite a few of right now, and they're trying to make their name with an anti-terrorism case, and they haul people into court, making a case against some activist group or some, you know, some individual, and they're arguing that these people are instilling a reasonable fear, how do you talk about reasonable fear in this political climate? That's like talking about what is a reasonable fear, you know, during the Red Scare. Well, it's not reasonable, but at that time, it's been manufactured and constructed in a way to make people afraid. There's no neutrality right now. All of this is being constructed. So, I mean, those are really the two bulk elements of how this law is supposed to work. If we look at the penalties, though, when I testified, I was attacked pretty heavily by Democrats who said, you know, this law isn't going to be used to go after First Amendment activity. And as a response to what I said, they included a rule of construction on the back page at the bottom, E1. It says, nothing shall be construed to prohibit any expressive conduct, including a peaceful picketing or other peaceful demonstration, protected from legal prohibition by the First Amendment to the Constitution. That sounds nice. You know, and I thank members of Congress for reminding us that there still is a First Amendment. But in legislation like this, and everyone that works on the Hill and everyone who knows Congress knows, it's moot. Just saying, trust us, this is constitutional, trust us, we're not going against the First Amendment, doesn't make it so. And I think the biggest concern of this entire piece of legislation isn't necessarily about the, you know, targeting people for damaging or interfering with a corporation. It's not about hauling someone before court about the reasonable fear. It's about the chilling effect that all of this is having. So while the government vociferously maintains that nothing in the law is going to be used against First Amendment activity, and even if we give them the benefit of the doubt, which I think we should absolutely not do on any occasion anymore, but if we give prosecutors and the FBI and DOJ and DHS and everyone the benefit of the doubt and say, okay, this law is not going to be used to go against people that are just picketing. It's not going to be used to go against another group like the Shack 7 who are just running a website. All that's going to end, they're not going against First Amendment activity. The true threat of the law, though, is the chilling effect it's having on mainstream people that are paying attention.
That was Will Potter from a speech given in March 2009. Next up, we have an interview with Robert Bloom, defense lawyer for one of the AETA-4. We begin by talking about terrorism.
Ever since 2001, that's like terrorism is everything. My favorite line is when the guy says, if you don't get intimate with me, that means the terrorists are winning. So everything is terrorism, and they've been able to scare this population so that anytime they hear or see the word terrorism, they turn against people who are so identified. And that's one of the purposes of this statute. There was a statute that was passed in 1992 called the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. Parenthetically, the idea that there's something, an entity or entities known as animal enterprises. In other words, we can do anything we want as human beings to other animals because animals are there to serve human beings. Aside from that concept, which is a whole other debate, they decided that the Animal Enterprise Protection Act wasn't strong enough, so that in 2004 and 5, the biomedical industry went to their favorite senator, a guy named Inhofe from Oklahoma, who everybody believed was the worst senator in the entire Senate, until Jim Bunning came along a couple of weeks ago. Senator Inhofe was approached by the very powerful lobby of the biomedical industry, as they call it, and I'm sure they gave him a lot of money to introduce the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And it actually found its way through Congress very quickly with very few hearings, but there were warnings. There were warnings by the ACLU and a couple of others that this statute was way too broad and way too vague, and it would sweep up people doing completely lawful things. Congress and President Bush, you remember him, well, President Cheney, with the help of President Bush, signed the act, and it became effective in 2008. This particular indictment, the AETA-4, that they have put in San Jose, California, is the very first indictment in this country under that statute. And just as the ACLU and others predicted, it's been misused. To put it as directly and clearly as possible, the ETA-4 are four of the nicest human beings I've ever met in my life, who were there to stop people from torturing and causing pain and death to animals. They are accused of being terrorists and facing 5 or even more years in prison for doing the following: researching the names and home addresses of people who worked in these labs where they use animals, experiment with animals. They went to their homes, and what did they do at their homes? They picketed. You know, it covered a period of about a year, and there were about 12 to 15 different demonstrations, which is all they are. They were completely public. That is, the people communicated with each other to meet for a demonstration or a picket on regular open internet sources. So it wasn't a secret. Not only wasn't it a secret, but on most of the incidents, the police were already there with visible video cameras. So nobody was trying to do anything clandestine. It was doing, I mean, it's been given a name, this kind of activity, called name and shame, to let the neighbors of these people know that right next door lives an animal torturer. They picketed in front of their homes. First Amendment, all the way. First Amendment. That's what the First Amendment was intended to do, intended to address, intended to protect, and yet it doesn't protect these four people. Now, that's only part of the problem, or part of the reasoning. One, it was to go after these four people to chill them. But secondly, other activists, let's start with animal rights activists, they see this statute, they see this indictment, and they say, geez, what can I do? What can one do and yet not be prosecuted? Well, the answer is, really, nothing. There's nothing you can't do that they wouldn't decide if they wanted to was terrorism. And there's yet another purpose, and it's the Trojan horse to get a foot in the door for people who are interested in other issues, like reproductive rights, race stuff, court stuff, police brutality, a whole range of issues, social and political issues. If they can do this, if the government wins in this case, we're all in big trouble. because the First Amendment really would have been, will be, so eviscerated and so meaningless that we really, it won't exist anymore. And that's the real danger and the importance. Obviously, the importance of this case has to do with the four defendants, but it has to do with all of us. And unless we put a stop to this, we're in bigger trouble than we've been for a long time.
You are listening to an interview with Robert Bloom, a defense lawyer for one of the AETA-4.
Picketing has been an accepted activity for generations. In fact, the law enforcement has been involved in picketing of its own, where police officers believe that one or more police officers have been mistreated by their bosses, the police department, the police commissioner. They've gone to the homes of the police commissioner and picketed in front of their homes, just like this. There's one that amuses me. There's a Peoria, Illinois, has these two vehicles that are like big tanks. And what they've been using them, they parked them, the Peoria police parked them in front of the homes of people they believe are doing drug trafficking. And they put big signs on these vehicles that they call the armadillo. And they say, in effect, the people who live in this house are drug dealers. They should also add, but we don't have enough proof, so we're just gonna say this informally. But police do it. Here in California, you may recall these two crazy people, a man and wife, kidnapped a young girl, an 11-year-old girl, and they held her captive for more than 10 years. The guy fathered two children with this little girl, and he was on parole, and the parole officer didn't detect it. So the parole officer got punished. He got sent to Duckburg, or wherever they send people, Siberia, as punishment. Well, the parole officers, his fellow parole officers, went to the home of the head of the parole department in the state of California, and they picketed in front of the home because this guy got transferred. It's been done forever. Obviously, the civil rights movement, women's rights movement, abortion issues, have been picketing all the time. So let me move to the next point that flows from that. The government seems to be saying that whatever these people were doing, my client and the other three, they scared, they frightened the people who were the targets of the picketing. Well, here's a question. What if you go to an anti-war rally, and some people at the end of the rally, 20 people, pick up some bricks and go off, unbeknownst to you, go off and break some windows? It's debated in political circles whether that's a wise or a helpful tactic, and that's a question of its own. But how about the people who went to the anti-war rally because they didn't like the idea of the United States murdering brown-skinned people in Iraq and Afghanistan? Should they be subject to some kind of terrorism punishment because 20 people went off and broke some windows? Well, the question answers itself. Of course not. And if, indeed, my client and the other three were involved in picketing, should they be subject to being called terrorists and put in prison, federal prison, for 5 or 10 years, because other people may have done some other things that scare the animal researchers? Well, of course not. But that's the government's theory. Senator Inhofe was quoted as saying at the time of the introduction of this statute, "Well, we can't seem to find the people who were doing the real damage," by which he meant the alleged Animal Liberation Front people who were involved allegedly in some arsons. So Imhoff says, "Well, we can't seem to catch them. Let's go after these picketers." He didn't use the word picketers, but let's go after the people who support them. Let's go after the people who use the First Amendment. The reason it's the First Amendment rather than the Fourth Amendment or the Eighth Amendment is because it was regarded by the founders of the Constitution as the most important aspect of the Bill of Rights, that people should have the right to speak up, say what's on their minds, and let people know where there's something wrong happening. And that's all that happened here.
Do you expect this to go to trial, or do you have expectations about how this is going to play out?
The answer is that criminal cases, basically there are three possibilities. One is it gets dismissed for one reason or another, which is what we're hoping for, because it is unconstitutional, the statute, and this indictment is unconstitutional. I want to talk about that in a second. It's quite amazing. So getting dismissed is one possibility. What happens with many cases, most cases in this country, is some plea bargain is reached. I don't think that's going to happen here because the defendants in this case did not do anything criminal. And I do not see any plea bargain being struck here. The third option is it goes to trial and the jury says what it has to say. I believe this case will go to trial. It's unclear when. It's not right now on a fast track, but we do go to court in a couple of weeks, and I think it's going to start accelerating. So realistically, I think not before the fall, possibly the first of the year, next year. But I wanted to say something about the indictment itself. As most indictments in federal court do nowadays, it has one substantive count and one conspiracy count. Whenever the government does a conspiracy count, they always load it up with what they call overt acts to make the events look serious and real. And let's take, not this case, but let's say a bank robbery case. And one overt act would be defendant number one bought a gun. Defendant number two stole a car. Defendant number three cased the bank, and so on. And they sometimes have 5, 10, 15 overt acts. And they say specifically, on a particular date, this defendant did such and such. This indictment is just the opposite. It's amazing. It has three what they call overt acts. The first one goes like this. On such and such a date, the defendants, and I'm using the exact words here, engaged in acts that violated the statute. The second overt act says on a different date, the defendants engaged in acts that violated the statute. At no point does the indictment say what those acts were. Why not? Well, because the acts were picketing and they were protected by the First Amendment. And it would be embarrassing to put in a public document an indictment that journalists would look at. Wait a minute. The indictment says that they picketed? Well, they don't want to say, the government doesn't want to say that because they'd be laughed out of town. But that's what this indictment says. There is a third overt act that says they used, two of the defendants used some entity in interstate commerce to research the names of employees at research labs. That's it. That is what this indictment says. It's astonishing. It's an indictment that I think is subject to dismissal because it doesn't say anything. And the reason it doesn't say anything, there are two reasons it doesn't say anything. One is, as I say, they'd be laughed out of town. And the other is, as I mentioned a little earlier, when you keep it vague like that, other activists are very chilled by that because they don't know what they can do and what they can't do. What they will do that might be subject to criminal prosecution. So it's intentionally left vague. It's a very underhanded, dishonest tactic, and it's also, I think, an unlawful tactic. But that's what this indictment does. It's astonishing. I've been around doing this for many years, and I've never, ever, out of, I'd say, hundreds of conspiracy indictments that I've looked at, I've never seen anyone like this.
How did you get involved with being one of the lawyers for this case?
I've been a lawyer for political activists for many years, much of it in New York and some of it after I moved here to the Bay Area. My work until a few years ago was all criminal cases, but I wound up getting involved with other lawyers in the case of Judy Barry, who was an Earth First activist, a wonderful woman who's since passed on. It was a civil case against the FBI and the Oakland police I don't really have time to go into detail, but we got a major victory against the FBI, in fact, the largest verdict ever against the FBI, over $4 million on behalf of Judy and her co-plaintiff, Daryl Cherney, both wonderful people. That led to doing another case. The Sheriff's Department in Humboldt County, California, used pepper spray against chained demonstrators, Earth First demonstrators, put pepper spray in their eyes from 2 or 3 inches away from their eyes. I mean, just horrendous, unspeakably horrible. And they sued the Humboldt County, and we won that case as well. So I guess I got a little bit of a reputation that I was interested in those kinds of cases. And when this one came along, I guess somebody sought me out. And to be honest, animal rights, I feel very strongly about animal rights now. At the time I was approached about the case, it was not at the top of my list of issues in which I was interested. It was one of the issues, but it was not at the top of the list. But then as I became knowledgeable about this case, and then became more knowledgeable about the issue of animal rights, I feel very, very strongly about it now. You know, one of the great things about doing the work that I do, great for me, is that each case takes me, connects me with different wonderful people, activists of one kind or another. I get to touch and experience a part of life that I would never know about. So it keeps my interest awake and keeps me awake.
You are listening to Circle A Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Tonight, we are talking about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and the Green Scare. We are currently listening to an interview with Bob Bloom, defense attorney for one of the AETA-4. It seems like a lot of the things that are now getting prosecuted against the animal rights activists are the same things that they were saying about Earth Liberation activists before September 11th, and that was when they were the number one domestic threat. It seems like it's still true by the way that the government treats these activists, is that they are still seen as the number one domestic threat.
Oh, totally. The FBI and other law enforcement agencies, they really need, it's kind of like the blood that they have to live on. They have to scare the crap out of people and make them think that the FBI is indispensable, and also make them think that the FBI is actually credible. Where, in fact, they're doing the same things they did to the Black Panthers and other organizations in the old back days. That's what they do. They need it to exist. Hoover called the Black Panther Party the most dangerous organization on Earth. And the law enforcement people these days, they've done the same with ALF and ELF and just and other people active in those causes. You know, I also represented Breonna Waters, who was not a member of ELF, but she was treated as if she were, and they scared the hell out of the jury in ways that they actually, apparently, started some fires and had ELF take credit for it during the time the jury in Breonna's case in Tacoma, Washington, was deliberating about whether she was guilty or not guilty. They actually, I'm convinced, were responsible for setting some fires in unoccupied new buildings outside of Seattle. They'll do anything to scare the population. And, you know, they were completely dishonest in Breonna's case. To this day, they are concealing FBI reports that would exculpate, help Breonna. Instead, they substituted inculpatory FBI reports that they made up after the fact. They'll do anything. People should be aware of that. There's been a fair amount of writing, and you can go on the internet to just punch up AETA-4, and there'll be a lot. One of the people who's been terrific in writing about this is a fellow named Will Potter. and I think he wrote something called Green is the New Red. And he continues to write and turn out really excellent stuff. If they want to write to me by email, it would be good. Bbloom, B-B-L-O-O-M, 222, at hotmail.com. I probably can't respond to all the emails, but I'll send some stuff along if people want it. If people want to contribute, we have it's tax-deductible through the National Lawyers Guild Foundation in New York. But if people want to do that, they should send me an email, and I'll get them the right information.
That was Bob Bloom, defense lawyer for one of the AETA-4. Carrie Feldman and Scott DeMuth are activists from Minneapolis, Minnesota, who were subpoenaed to a federal grand jury in Iowa investigating animal rights vandalism from 2004. They both refused to cooperate with the grand jury and were put in jail. Carrie is still being held on civil contempt of court. On November 19, 2009, Scott's civil contempt was dropped, and he was indicted for conspiracy under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Scott was released on November 30th, pending trial. This is Tom Addo from Ewok, Earth Warriors Are Okay, and Jude with the Scott and Carrie Support Committee. Can you tell us about Carrie and Scott and who they were and what they're being charged with?
Scott and Carrie are two friends of ours and two residents of Minneapolis. Carrie is currently being detained, going into month five of being detained in Iowa for refusing to testify in front of a federal grand jury. Scott DeMuth is a friend of ours who's, Scott's actually being charged with conspiracy to maybe know something about something that happened at the University of Iowa. He's not actually being charged with any sort of crime. He's more of a thought crime under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. These are both related to an action that took place at the University of Iowa by the Animal Liberation Front in 2004. The thing to keep in mind when we're having this conversation is that Scott's charging papers were basically filed one day before the statutes of limitations expired on this action. And so by charging Scott, it allows the investigators and the federal government to basically keep their case open and to keep investigating and to keep looking into things. So,
what can you tell us about that action that happened at the university in Iowa?
In 2004, members of the ALS broke into a research lab at the University of Iowa, released some rats and damaged computers and research, basically forced the University of Iowa to build, just like folks on the West Coast are familiar with, building their research labs underground so that they, they're not susceptible to those kinds of things. And it was actually one of the first lab raids in a long time. You know, at that point, the Animal Liberation Front had predominantly been operating, doing, fur releases and smaller scale kinds of stuff. And this was the first lab break-in in a few years when it happened.
That was Tom Addo. This is Jude with the Scott and Carrie Support Committee.
Grand juries are a tool that prosecutors have available to them, both at the state and federal level, to seek indictments against people. And the way they've been used, particularly at the federal level, against activists in the past in the United States, has been to use the grand juries to get information maybe about like alleged crimes that occurred, but also about communities and about organizations that are struggling against the dominant system. And so Carrie is right now being held on civil contempt for refusing to testify in front of the grand jury. So she's not being charged with a crime. She's basically being held to coerce her into testifying and complying with the grand jury. But she, like many other activists, has decided that she does not want to cooperate with the system at all as a matter of principle. And when that happens, people who are subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury are typically given immunity so that anything that they tell the grand jury can't be used against them. But even with like the legal technicalities of it, it's not actually like a free check to say whatever they want, because it's a very limited immunity that they're typically given. So it's a dangerous thing to cooperate and try to play the game with them, even if you think you can get a good deal. And because the system itself is such a powerful like and secret thing, where like the people who are subpoenaed are coming to go into front of the grand jury without a lawyer, and there's no judge in the room, so they don't have a lawyer, there's no judges, the prosecutor, and 23 people on the grand jury who can ask them anything that they want. Doesn't have to be about any alleged crime at all, and the prosecutor doesn't have to tell them like what's being investigated, and even whether they're a target of the investigation. So basically, people have to go in blind and not know like what is going on at all. And because the whole thing is so shady and abusive, a lot of activists have decided to refuse to cooperate, which is what Kerry has done. And then when that happens, as I said, like they get immunity and they still refuse to cooperate, and they're held on civil contempt to be coerced into changing their mind and testifying. And with a civil charge like that, she's not facing a crime. She's not facing like any criminal charges. So the system that she's in is drastically different than what Scott's in right now with facing the conspiracy charges under the AETA. And with Kerry's situation, she can be held for the duration of the grand jury, which is typically 12 months, but it can go up to 18. And she was incarcerated after the first month of the grand jury had run its course. So she's facing up to like at least 11 months, unless her lawyers are able to argue that she'll never be coerced in testifying. And so like any kind of imprisonment that she's facing is a punishment, which is illegal under the grand jury laws.
Scott got indicted on the last possible moment. So does that mean that Kerry, they can't possibly indict her even if they wanted to, because that statute of limitation has passed?
Another thing to keep in mind, too, is Kerry and Scott were respectively 15 and 17 in 2004 when this action happened. So, you know, and having been friends with them for a long time and knowing them coming up and stuff, like, I don't say Kafka-esque with any sort of, like, looseness to it. I don't think that they really think that they actually did it. I think the strategy of charging somebody allows them to actually, since they've charged Scott along with unnamed co-conspirators, that basically nulls this statute, this time limit, because the investigation is still ongoing because somebody has been charged. My understanding is it's a trick that prosecutors have used in the past, not necessarily for political cases like this. It's not an unusual move to basically buy more time. If you look in, you know, the year before, in 2008, here in the Midwest, when we were dealing with stuff around an Earth Liberation Front action in Rhinelander up in Wisconsin, they had done the same thing. They ended up basically charging people at the last minute, the day before the statute's limitations expired, and that allowed them to keep their investigation open, which brought in a couple of extra people, and they ended up charging 5 people total with that.
I'd like to add one thing to that. The prosecutor, Cliff Cronk, had said in open court during the hearing for Scott that it would be ridiculous to charge Kerry with being involved in this action because she's only 15 at the time. We've definitely seen like this prosecutor, Cronk, straight out lie in open court. So it very well be that he would seek to indict her at some point. But he's even admitted that it's utterly ridiculous to think that she was involved in any way, which just leads us to believe like even more strongly that the reason that she was subpoenaed in the first place is to get information like on our communities and on Scott in particular, because that's what they're trying to do, like to get any kind of like chance at a conviction of Scott, is like having information about his life and about his community, because they have nothing to link him to the action itself.
So can you tell us where Scott's case stands at this point?
Right now it looks like Scott's trial will be in the beginning of May. He has another round of hearings coming up on April 12th, and the trial is set for May 3rd for a trial call, which is a system that the Southern District of Iowa has, where cases are like brought in front of a judge like to determine like which ones will be tried in which order. So it's really hard to say exactly when Scott will be up for trial, but most likely be sometime in May. The difficulties with that, in addition to just like having adequate time for his defense lawyer to prepare for trial and not having anything in the indictment to really say, like, how he should prepare, because we don't really know exactly what Scott is being charged with. But some other difficulties are that Scott lives in Minneapolis, his lawyer lives in Chicago, and the court is in Davenport, Iowa. So if Scott is brought up for trial, like, at a moment's notice, it's going to be extremely difficult to get him down there, like, on time. So we're not really sure how things are going to play out with that. Another thing to know about Scott's situation right now is that when he first hired on his lawyer, Michael Deutsch, from the People's Law Office in Chicago, Michael, like, filed a whole bunch of motions right away to try to get the charges dismissed. And the prosecutor, Kronk, didn't respond to those directly, but what he did instead was to re-indict Scott with a slightly more specific indictment, but it's still, like, so vague that Scott's lawyer doesn't really know how to defend against it. And the effect was that all those motions that Scott's lawyer filed to have the charges dismissed became, like, null and void, so he has to refile those motions with a new indictment, but he's not given any additional time before the trial date is set. So Scott is doing a tremendous amount of work, and his legal team is as well, to prepare for this trial as best they can. But the prosecutor is using every trick that I can possibly think of to make it almost impossible to mount a strong defense.
Here in Minneapolis, particularly in the last few years, we've just been facing an intense amount of pressure on our community. And the fact that this is happening 6 hours away does make it really hard to do the physical support work. In this case, frankly, the feds, as much as we like to joke about it, they're not stupid. You know, they think very strategically, and they wouldn't have tried to bring these charges here in the Twin Cities because of the outcry, the pressure. We would have been out in the streets every day. We would have been at the courthouse every day. Instead, they've got this gung-ho, podunk county prosecutor. The guy's a loose cannon. He plays very loose with the law. We're trying to mount a pressure campaign, and it's basically in unfriendly territory, miles away from any sort of home base. That definitely has added to the difficulty of trying to do the support work.
Well, can you tell us more about the work of the Scott and Carrie Support Committee?
Scott and Carrie Support Committee is made up of people involved in a lot of different projects. Scott and Carrie, I'm speaking as a member of EWOC, which is Earth Warriors Are Okay. We are an Earth and Animal Liberation anti-grand jury group. We've been around about 3 years. Scott and Carrie worked with EWOC. So Scott and Carrie Support Committee is made up of people from EWOC, some other friends. Scott's an academic researcher at the University of Minnesota, and so some of his colleagues in the academic community are on board with that. There's also people from Cold Snap and some of the other sort of legal collectives in town here. It's two people, and it's two sort of separate things. With Carrie, it's a lot of seeing where she's at in jail, making sure she's comfortable, making sure she's got money in her commissary. The phone systems in every jail are different. Some jails are prepay. Some jails, you've got to put money on your phone at home. Some jails, you can't call cell phones. Carrie's been moved around several times, and so I'm trying to be very proactive so that, okay, she's been moved. Well, let's make sure there's money and find out what the phone company is and, you know, put $50 on her phone so she can talk to us for 5 minutes. Making sure she's getting letters, books, you know, more that prisoner support type work. That's kind of what a lot of it has been around Carrie. With Scott, it's been trying to do media, trying to get support from the radical and academic communities, trying to sort of, you know, show, at least in our community where we live, the larger Twin Cities community, that this is happening 6 hours away. That's kind of been a problem because it isn't necessarily right in people's backyard. I think it falls off the radar. Moral support, what do you need from us? How do we, you know, what do we do to keep going? Some of us are also caught up in our own court struggles right now. So we're pulled pretty thin here in the Twin Cities, but I do think that we've done a really good job of trying to get their backs and also keep the grand jury stuff going. Before Carrie was called before a grand jury, some of the work that she did around the Twin Cities as a member of EWOC and as a member of Cold Snap was doing grand jury resistance workshops and know your rights trainings, talking to the radical community and the activist community and just folks in South Minneapolis about your rights dealing with the police and about how to deal with grand juries. And Kerry has been a shining example, I think, of how to do it. So trying to kind of keep her work going and keeping the grand jury stuff as part of the issue and not forgetting about that. The charges may happen, but grand juries are going to have been used in the past and will continue to be used as tools to try to break our will. And hopefully we can come out of this without any friends in jail and stronger for it.
And the support committee has also been doing a lot of fundraising. There's been a tremendous amount of money needed for commissary, for Kerry, as well as legal fees for both Kerry and Scott. As I said before, like, Scott has a really excellent lawyer who's very well equipped to defend him in court, but he's also very expensive. We've been doing a tremendous amount of fundraising, but also receiving a ton of help from people around the nation, and even from Canada and other places. People have been put on fundraisers or hosting potlucks or showing movies or anything that they can think of, really, to get money that they've been sending into us to help out with all these legal fees.
You're listening to an interview with Tom and Jude, Minneapolis activists engaged in support work for grand jury resister Kerry Feldman and Scott DeMuth, indicted for conspiracy under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Have you had the opportunity to link up with people who have faced grand juries, like the Puerto Rican independence movement had a lot of people jailed for resisting grand juries, or other movements?
In a physical sense, we haven't linked that way. But I do think if you look at the stuff that's come out around the Scott Kerry sports stuff, and a lot of the people that are involved with that are also part of defense around the RNC 8 case here in Minneapolis. These are just small parts of these larger struggles. We have to make those links, I think, with some of, not necessarily with Scott and Kerry stuff, and I guess I'm stepping aside from that, but just in these larger struggles, around the RNC 8 stuff, there's a lot of people that are very supportive of them. People have used that opportunity to say, well, hey, you support these guys, what about these people? And have been very forthcoming about tying it into the Puerto Rican liberation and the Black Liberation Movement. I'd like to make those links. We just had a speaker the other day, Peter Erlander, who's a law professor at Hamline University here in the Twin Cities. What's going on right now here in the Twin Cities is one of the largest federal investigations into terrorism. These are their words. And that's happening. And what they're doing is they're targeting the Somali communities here in the Twin Cities. Basically, we have the largest urban population of Somalis outside of Mogadishu. And so what's been happening, and I don't know if you've been following it, is these Somali kids are going back to their homelands to fight the occupiers or the invaders. They're fighting Ethiopia and the Ethiopian army and other forces, and so they're being called terrorists. And there's been a bunch of kids that have been disappearing. And Peter was talking about how in the Somali community, they're facing grand juries every day, and that there was a kid who was in a grand jury recently, and, 15, 16-year-old kid, and he wasn't thinking about being the center of this massive investigation. He was thinking about, oh, my God, I'm going to miss my math test today. And I would love to make those inroads, especially with those communities, because I think that there's a sense that, oh, we have to cooperate. It's the American thing to do. We have to cooperate. We have to help the government. We have to, especially when you're talking about at-risk communities where any sort of something wrong on your application is grounds to be kicked out of this country. So there's a lot of fear, and I'd like to be able to use my small amount of privilege to be able to support people that would be resisting grand juries from those communities.
Thanks for bringing that to our attention as well. I think that's really important for our listeners to hear about. Jude, did you want to add anything?
Several members of the support committee have been able to draw on people that they know, as well as friends of friends who have been involved in different struggles, such as Black Panthers and other groups that have been targeted by grand juries in the past. So we have been able to establish some connections and benefit from people's knowledge and experiences. But one thing that we're extremely conscious of, in all of our support work, is how we make those connections to broader struggles and to repression that people have faced in the past at different times, as well as things that are happening currently and things that we know are going to happen in the future. We're trying to situate what's happening to Scott and Kerry within a much broader context. And the relevance for people who aren't currently facing grand juries is that the system itself exists, and it exists in great secrecy, and it can be like employed against third communities at any time. And so it makes a lot of sense to educate themselves about what's going on and learn from the examples that other people set within the struggle, like both like for the better and for the worse. And it's like when they're faced with it, to be able like, to respond in a way that's going to strengthen their community and strengthen the struggle and not allow the government to have one more inroad into destroying us.
And so how can our listeners help support the work of the committee?
Not only do we need your help to do radio shows and be in the media, we need help. You know, these things don't come cheaply. But also, you know, organize in your backyard. And having done on and off for the last couple of years doing different prisoner support stuff and being kind of out there on the Internet, sometimes we get these, like, you know, we get these emails from people like, oh, how do we, you know, we got this happening, and how do we, you know, how can we do this, and how can we do this? And I think this information is out there, and I think it's one of the best ways to really keep our movement going forward is to keep having these conversations and keep talking about things and get people prepared. I mean, we honestly, these are the last two people I would have thought would have been targeted for something like this, and they were prepared for it because they talked about it, because we had these conversations, because we had meetings, because as friends we said, hey, this is what I'm prepared to do, and this is how you can support me when I decide to do it, because this is going to keep happening, and this isn't just about, and I'm really glad you brought up the stuff with the independentistas. This isn't just, I think a lot of people see this as just, this is an animal rights issue, but it's a lot bigger than that. This is about everybody's ability to keep going forward and dissent.
Some other things people can do, if they don't have the capacity to organize events to raise the awareness, to like really develop that knowledge within their own communities, even something as simple as like writing a letter to Carrie, like while she's in jail, and just saying, hey, I'm from wherever, USA, and I've heard about what's happening to you, and here's what I'm doing, like, with my life and things that I want to work on, like, whatever, just, like, reaching out and offering, like, solidarity, like, to Carrie and to other political prisoners who are in jails right now. And, you know, like, that could be the start, and people can work from there to develop, like, a broader, like, structure within their own communities to, like, support all political prisoners, because that's one thing that the government tries to keep very hidden from people, and their official like rhetoric is that like there are no political prisoners in the United States, but that's obviously untrue, and they need all of our support.
That was Jude from the Scott and Carrie Support Committee, and Tom Addo from EWOC, Earth Warriors Are Okay. Thanks to them, as well as to Bob Bloom and Will Potter. Links to resources that these folks spoke of and more information about the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act and the Green Scare can be found on our website, kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. We can be contacted through the KBOO website or at CircleARadio@gmail.com. Our next show airs April 7th. Thanks for listening.